The Dharma takes many forms, including announcements. I want to talk on the topic that I didn't talk about 2 weeks ago, and that is the topic of peace and nonviolence. 2 weeks ago on Sunday, I met here with the small interreligious group of people to discuss nonviolence and conflict resolution from the perspective of different religious traditions. And I've never been part, actually once before, but never really been part of an interreligious panel or dialogue. And didn't have a lot of particularly strong interest in it, but I'm very interested in the topic of nonviolence and conflict resolution, and was happy to contribute what Buddhism had to say about it. And one of the delights of the evening, or the morning, was really enjoying myself in this kind of interreligious discussion. I think the fact that we had this topic of nonviolence to share, and everybody had their own perspectives and what they brought to it and their experiences with it, and it was kind of inspiring for me. And you know, that kind of interreligious dialogue I'd be happy to do a lot more of. My earliest interest in Buddhism stemmed from my interest in nonviolence and conflict resolution. It was still during the Vietnam War, and I was very draftable. And I was 17, 18, 19 years old, wondering what to do if I was drafted. And I'd grown up in high school and maybe junior high school years in Los Angeles. And maybe those of you remember that era, at least in the Los Angeles Times, you'd open up to the second or third page and there'd be a whole row of photographs of the young men who died the day before, you know, days before. And that was day after day after day, you see these photographs of who had died, who'd been killed. And so the idea of war and the idea of violence and the idea of its destruction was something that I felt kind of sensitive to because of the predicament of a draftable young man. And so in the college dorms, kind of wondering what we would do if we were drafted, there was a lot of discussion about the draft and about war. And I always took the extreme pacifist point of view. And I recognized that in my pacifist stance, it was an activist stance. It was one that advocated nonviolent action in response or in reaction to injustice or wrongs of the world. And I saw they had the example around me of other college students who had gotten killed on college campuses and beaten up and skulls broken and whatever because they had demonstrated against the war. So I could feel in me that my intellectual, rational concept about what I wanted to do was to be able to act in nonviolent ways. But my emotional side was that I was afraid to die. I was afraid to put myself in a situation where my life might be threatened. And I wasn't at all happy about the gap between my belief, or my ideal, and my emotional capacity. And so I was attracted to Buddhism initially as a way, as a technique or as a practice, to help me deal with my fear of death. And I thought, I didn't go very far. I mean, that's about as far as it went. I read books and stuff, and I didn't really start then looking into my fear of death and resolving it. But that was my initial interest in Buddhism, actually. And I think Buddhism has that to offer, has to offer us the opportunity to really look very deeply at how we are afraid of our death, how we're afraid of life, maybe, how we cling to it, our attachments. And to come to some kind of term, some kind of ease, or some kind of peace about dying. I think a person who's willing to die, or is not afraid of dying, is much more effective servant to the world, much more effective effective in responding in dire, extreme situations when it's required of us to respond nonviolently and to whatever is going on. And I'm struck, you know, that in my growing up, mostly in America, but also some in Europe, it's a phenomenal amount of peace has occurred. On this continent itself, there's been some killing and fighting, but there hasn't been any war here inside this border for a long time. And I haven't actually directly come into contact with war and the kind of devastation that war can make. The closest I came to was when I visited Israel a few years ago, and we went and visited the Lebanese border. And while we were visiting the Lebanese border, a mortar shell landed was shot from Lebanon into Israel and landed maybe, I don't know, 500 yards away in some field. So that was the closest that I've ever gotten to it. I saw a lot of the remnants of war growing up. I also grew up some in Europe. And in Europe, you see lots of leftover wars. Just playing in the fields in Italy, we just find these, you know, things left over from World War I and World War II, just stuff in the ground in the fields, and bunkers and stuff. And I remember also when I was growing up in Italy in the 60s, hearing lots of stories of people who lived through World War II, and being very moved by that. Especially the stories of the people who somehow or other survived the concentration camps. One friend of my father's was put up in the firing squad and shot, and the bullet went through his ear, and he fainted, and woke up, in a pile of bodies in some forest somewhere, and crawled out and escaped. A very close family friend says he escaped from. He was a Italian soldier, and when the Italians basically surrendered, the Germans arrested all those Italian soldiers who wouldn't fight for the Germans. So he was in Germans' camps for a while, and he says he escaped 7 times. And one time they were going to shoot him, but it was a reprieve in the last minute. And the 7th time they didn't re-catch him. Because that's when the Americans kind of basically rolled in. And my in-laws, both of them, survived the German concentration camps. Lost almost everyone in their family except for them. And when I was then living in Italy growing up, we went and visited Lebanon when I was 11. Lebanon was this fantastically beautiful and prosperous country. And then to read about the devastation of Lebanon, especially the Israeli bombing of Lebanon in the early 80s, made it feel very close at home, because Lebanon was just like, you know, it's like a neighbor country from where I was living in Italy. It's part of the Mediterranean. And I felt that, this bombing was happening in a place where I could be. So even though it's remarkable how much peace that I've lived in my life, you know, basically having direct contact with war, 40 years, what is it, 40, 50 years now, right, of kind of peace. We've go to war everywhere else, but kind of peace is quite remarkable, I think, for anybody, but for especially maybe for a male or for anybody, to grow up in a culture, in a country where there hasn't been really a war in the country itself for so long. It's not the experience of a lot of people until recently in Europe. So I don't know when things are going to take a turn for the other direction. When we're going to have war again that really touches us directly. We had the Gulf War a few years ago that touched us. And then there was a great flurry of people talking about peace and war. But it's easy to forget about it and really to look at this issue when there's a lot of peace and doesn't seem really pertinent to our lives. But I would argue that the issue of peace and the issue of war is always pertinent to us to try to understand. One of the things that distressed me about the Persian Gulf War was the number of times I heard people in America talk about the Gulf War as being reclaiming America's pride. You know, our pride had been hurt during the Vietnam War, and now we have to regain our pride by really bombing the hell out of Saddam. And, you know, regardless of what we think about that particular war, to have that to be an element of justification for why we're fighting, I find to be very, very disturbing and distressing. And that should be kind of an undercurrent of at least some people in American culture, in American society, that's ready to kind of bubble up in situations of great conflict, worries me. It's always there. The undercurrents, the subconscious undercurrents of the roots and the causes of war are always present, even when they're not happening. So at this gathering, that Sunday morning here, talk about nonviolence, the first person who spoke was a man from the Baha'i tradition. And we were supposed to talk about what each tradition had to offer nonviolence and conflict resolution. And I know next to nothing about the Baha'is, except that they're often oppressed in some cultures. And he gave a beautiful presentation or discussion about what he called a consultation process, a council process, a process of dialogue where people in conflict come together and sit in a circle and go through these procedures where they try to kind of come to some kind of resolution and a solution to their particular issues that parties are struggling with. And it was kind of inspiring to hear about this kind of group process. I was second in the discussion, and especially following him, what I said what Buddhism has to offer is the practices that help us look deep inside of ourselves to understand the roots of violence, of aggression, of peace and compassion deep inside of ourselves. Because there's lots of examples, and we had it in the 60s for sure, of people who are dedicated to the peace movement, but they were very angry people. And some of the ways they treated each other were kind of actually not physically violent, but maybe emotionally violent. And unless we can really understand the human individual sources and causes for war and violence and aggression, the chances of us perpetuating it keep going on and on. So in mindfulness practice, turns the mirror back to study ourselves, to study those roots that exist in each one of us, those roots that can blossom into aggression or blossom into compassionate action. All violence that's found in the world, you know, you read any kind of, you know, the front page of the newspaper and read about war and murder and destruction that humans create on humans. It's all born inside of the individual psyche, individual heart. You might attribute it to sociological or political or economic factors, but it has a genesis always in an individual who makes a choice to do something that's violent. And to the degree which violence then is always has its root in the individual, Buddhism offers, and other religions have this too, but Buddhism offers very powerful practices to turn that mirror back at these deep roots within ourselves and really to uncover them, remembering that these roots are not really necessarily accessible to us in everyday life. The tendencies for us to get angry, you know, the fact that you know, we're motivated by pride, for example, it's not that often that our pride is challenged. So we don't see the fact that pride is a root deep inside. So the roots of greed and hate. I was quite surprised when I was in the monastery in Japan. You know, this is a spiritual place, and you know, it was a Zen monastery in the meditation hall. Was the closest I ever got as an adult to punching someone out.
Yeah.
I was really surprised. You know, somehow the contrast of the place, you know, and me, you know, really made it stand out even more. But I was really surprised that I had this, that this bubbled up inside of me, the amount of anger and frustration and hurt that I felt toward this other person would bubble up to such a degree that I actually felt like I wanted to punch him out. And, you know, I'd spent 10 years previously doing spiritual practices, living in monasteries, being quite calm and serene, and never seen that I had the ability to punch someone out. So that kind of was a wake-up call that maybe I should look deeper. And so that's the function of mindfulness practice, is to help us to look deeper, to understand ourselves in the roots. Well, a footnote, or just a whatever, tangent thing. I just finished teaching this 8-day retreat in Santa Cruz, New Year's retreat, and there were at least 10 people from our Sangha there at that retreat. It was kind of inspiring to have so many of us kind of show up there and sit. So it's like 20% of the retreat was in Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. So Buddhism has a very strong teaching or a very strong emphasis or puts a lot of value on nonviolence. And the word is ahimsa, not to harm. And the five precepts that Buddhists try to follow can be understood. The principle behind the five precepts is the principle of not harming, trying not to harm people through our actions, through our by stealing, not to harm people through our speech, not harming people through our sexuality, not harming through intoxicants. The idea of not harming. I think it's useful to think of this as the principle behind the precepts. Otherwise, there's a tendency to see the precepts as rules, and rules kind of black and white. But there's really the principle of not harming is the what gives the precepts their life and their juice. And so in the particular situations we find ourselves in, what is the how do we follow through on this ideal or this principle of not harming? And the first of the five precepts is the precept not to kill. And nonviolence or non-harming can also be understood as being non-aggression. And I think it's maybe a very useful word for us, because nonviolence maybe is too idealistic. You know, well, that's only if there's a war I'll be nonviolent, or I don't punch people out, so nonviolence is not an issue for me. But non-aggression, as a translation of ahimsa, I think that many of us can do acts of aggression very subtly. Some people are masters at the subtlety of aggression so that no one knows they're being aggressive. Forcing themselves onto someone else, forcing other people to do something. But part of the nuanced understanding of ahimsa or non-aggression in Buddhism, as I understand it, is also not forcing the teachings of non-violence in other people. And it's very clear that Buddhist monastics who really take vows and really dedicate their lives and enter into a particular spiritual community are held to a very high standard of nonviolence. But there doesn't seem to be any clear demand within Buddhism, any clear kind of requirement, you're not supposed to sign somewhere or take a vow or something, of nonviolence. The Buddha didn't seem particularly to want to impose strict requirements of nonviolence on the lay Buddhists or lay practitioners. And I think part of the reason for that is the Buddha didn't feel like it was his place in the world to do that. And people who joined him, who joined his particular order of monks and nuns, he could tell them, you know, well, you know, you should be nonviolent. But there's a kind of respect for lay people, and respect for everyone, that you're not going to impose some particular teaching or some particular behavior on them as if this is what they have to do. That's a kind of aggression. So even the idea of nonviolence, to impose that or insist on that, isn't found in Buddhism. You don't find a very clear demand that lay Buddhists are supposed to be nonviolent. I would hope they are. But there's this kind of experience, this sense of giving people lots of freedom, or not imposing themselves. Buddhism doesn't want to impose itself on Buddhists or people who aren't Buddhists. It doesn't want to impose itself. But rather, the source of spiritual authority, the source of our decision making, should really come from within ourselves. And so the practice of mindfulness then becomes a very important practice, because it's what kind of turns the mirror of awareness back on ourselves, so we can understand not only the roots of aggression and compassion within ourselves, but also can understand the source of our values that we want to live our life by. So the values of our life are not imposed from outside as if they're a good idea, don't come from Buddhism, but rather our values come from our intuition, perhaps, our intuitive knowing and deep knowing within ourselves, that we know this for ourselves. So it's a little bit embarrassing then to go to interreligious kind of dialogue discussion about Buddhism and nonviolence and say, well, actually Buddhism doesn't talk a lot about nonviolence. It doesn't say you're supposed to be nonviolent, because we don't want to impose that on anyone. We don't want to have that as a kind of aggressive kind of stance, that Buddhism is an authority and this is the way you should live your life. Isn't that kind of odd? So peace is not the absence of conflict. Peace is the absence of aggression. And that's a very important point, I think, to distinguish. Some people are afraid of conflict, and so they'll do anything they can to avoid it. But I think conflict is a part of life, and if we're going to live a responsible life, we're going to find ourselves in conflict with other people. But being in conflict with other people doesn't mean that we're that there's any aggression involved. It can be tremendous respect and tremendous care and compassion and honesty in situations of conflict. I'm running out of time. What I'd like to do is tell you a story from the suttas, the Buddhist sutras, of what the Buddha did when there was a war was beginning to flare up between his home country and the neighboring country or the neighboring tribal community. These two countries in the foothills of the Himalayas had a river called Rohini. And Rohini River was the border between the two countries. And one year it was a drought year. And so there wasn't enough water to irrigate all the crops that they had planted. And so they each wanted to take water from that river, that creek or whatever it was. But there wasn't enough water in the river for both countries or both sides. So it seemed like a good, a wonderful opportunity for conflict. So each side insisted on having all the water that they needed, which didn't leave enough for the other side. So that escalated into name-calling. And so they started calling each other terrible names and, you live in trees. And it's relatively polite, in the scriptures at least. But name-calling kind of escalated until the warriors were ready to fight, go to war. And at which point the Buddha heard about it and walked there alone and entered into the middle of the field where the soldiers were kind of facing each other. And he asked first, what was the conflict about? And it took a while for them to be able to explain it to him, because as sometimes happens in conflicts, the name calling and it escalated in such a point that the feeling of resentment and anger and the feelings of hurt had gone way beyond the water issue into what people had said to each other. And they kind of forgotten about the water. And I think sometimes that's what happens in conflict. We forget the root cause, but rather our reactions to it get kind of more and more out of hand. And then it's almost impossible to reconcile, because we've called each other terrible things and no one wants to talk to each other anymore. So after they finally got down and explained to him the original cause, the issue of the water, the Buddha asked them, what's more valuable, the water in the river or the blood of a warrior? And they all kind of looked at each other and said, well, the blood of a warrior. And at which point they put down their swords and went home. They felt it was kind of silly to fight over water and spill blood. So that's a story. And I think it's a nice story. It shows a kind of engaged Buddhism. It shows the Buddha willing to walk into the middle of conflict. It shows, I think, the Buddha going into a situation and not taking sides. Even though it was his home country was involved in it, he went in kind of alone and empty-handed and just kind of stood there, not taking sides, and first asking questions, inquiring, what's this going on here? And letting them explain to him what was happening. In walking into the middle of the field, you might say that the Buddha also put himself at risk. And this was the issue when I was 18, 19. I was too afraid of putting myself at risk. To enter in a situation, there was risk if I was going to try to resolve or try to respond to conflict. But the Buddha was willing to put himself into the middle. And he came alone, not holding on to any identity. I don't think he was holding on to his identity as being from one particular country or one particular tribe or whatever. He just came as a neutral party to listen. And then he didn't use force in talking to them. It's perhaps you could have said he could have used his spiritual charisma, which the sutras say he had lots of, and kind of, you know, put them all to shame for what they were doing. But rather, the image I have of him is just coming very simply, and as a simple person saying, what's going on here? And can you explain it to me? And then asking a simple question that kind of put it all in a different context for those soldiers, that they then didn't want to fight. So the idea of using investigation rather than force, and that's one of the fundamental principles of Buddhist, maybe any kind of reconciliation process, but certainly Buddhist reconciliation, is to find some means of doing careful investigation, careful inquiry, asking questions, letting people kind of state their point of view, their perspective, and slowly kind of getting all the pieces and all the into place till you get the whole picture, the widest picture. Part of the challenge, in conflict resolution, is to see if the parties involved can find a perspective of a conflict that's much bigger than they imagined they ever before, that holds both parties or all parties' best interests in mind. The usual tendency, I think, in conflict is it's you and me, us and them. And there's one of us is going to win, one of us is going to lose, or there's not enough for both of us. And I've seen many times in places where I've been in conflict where I was willing to hang in there in the conflict in a non-aggressive way. And it was very frustrating. I don't like being in conflict one bit. But willing to be in there and willing to be uncomfortable. At some point, someone would have this bright idea or bright understanding or a perspective that would suddenly kind of quantumly understand the whole situation in a whole new way where everybody could be satisfied. Everybody's needs were taken care of. But if we didn't hang in there to kind of with the conflict, this quantum kind of leap couldn't have happened. And I can't think of a particularly good example right now that except which I've used before in writing the document for conflict resolution at Zen Center, how the San Francisco Zen Center was going to resolve conflicts within its community. That committee that I was on that was writing that document, we had a lot of conflict. and it has to do with ethics, so it was really charged at times. And how we would hang in there and hang in there and hang in there. I'm right, no, I'm right, and I'm not going to budge. And we would hang in there and kind of say, well, what else? Can we look at it from a different point of view? Is there a kind of meta picture? Is there some different way we can say this so that both of us can be happy? Is there a solution for both of us so that neither of us has to be right or wrong? So I think investigation, and be willing to investigate, in respectful ways, very important part of the process. So I'm running out of time. Maybe that's enough. I like at least once a year to talk about peace and nonviolence. Maybe we should talk about it more, but I just want to take the opportunity and encourage you all to think about it and not wait for the next war before you think about it. We need to take time for one or two questions. Yes?
What kept you from punching that person out?
No, I can't tell you at this point, this distance, what kept me. Well, you know, I feel that it's wrong to hurt someone. I don't want to hurt someone. Once, for good cause, when I was about 20, this guy wanted to fight with me. He had, you know, if someone had good cause, he had good cause. And he showed up, and I still have, you know, the image of what happened. It's in my eyes still. You know, he walked across this field, storming up at me, and said, "Okay, this is it. Let's fight." And he was this big, strong guy, and I dropped down on my knees and put my hands out, but kind of intuitively, I wasn't even thinking. I just dropped on my knees and put up my hands like this, and said, "I can't fight." And then he turned around disgustedly and left. And so I left the field of battle in one piece. So I don't know. But it's just a very strong motivation within me not to cause harm. Yeah.
What was it that made you so angry?
Well, you know, my perspective of the situation might not be the accurate one. But this is a fellow who sat next to me in the meditation hall for 5 months. And we actually slept next to each other, and we kind of, there, you know, next to each other a lot. He hated me. And he had an attitude you find occasionally in Japan among Japanese Zen Buddhists and monks, that Japanese Zen is for Japanese only. And only if you're Japanese can you understand it. And only if you're Japanese does it even make sense for your practice, because it's Japanese, it's Japanese culture. It's not, you know, something universal. And so why does this foreigner come and do this thing which is only for Japanese? So he didn't like me being there. He couldn't understand it. And I think he was someone who was very insecure. Also, he was one day senior to me in the monastery. So, there's a kind of feel, in Japanese monasteries, a feeling of hierarchy is very important, and one day is a huge amount of difference. So, you know, he felt like he could lord over me. And he would do various strange things as we were sitting there in meditation. Sometimes, you know, I nod off in zazen in my meditation, or my eyes are kind of whatever. And he would do things like poke at me. Kind of aggressively, you know, poke at me like this. Or he'd make these demands, you have to do this, you have to do that. And it kind of built over time. And I remember one day kind of feeling really angry and fuming at him. So it's in me. Or it was then. It's probably still in there. Yes?
I was just really inspired last year by meeting Ajahn Jungian and his stories about going out in the conflict in Thailand between, I guess, the communist insurgents and just a lot of personal bravery, putting himself in the middle of that, talking them into turning in weapons.
Yes, if you have a chance, Ajahn Jungian is coming back to Spirit Rock this spring. Ajahn Jungian is this fantastically original and inspiring and Buddhist teacher. And he did very many inspiring things, kind of in the middle of the war and the conflict between the communist guerrillas and the government in southern Thailand, putting himself in great danger. He tells stories of walking through gunfire in order to go find abandoned children and bring them back to his monastery. So that's enough, or one more, then we'll stop.
I just want to congratulate you for next Monday. And
thank you. Thank you. I will tell someone how the outcome is so it can be announced next Monday. So thank you.